Bethesda Theater presents the SOS Band on Friday and Saturday, September 20th and 21st. Spyro Gyral celebrating their 50th anniversary on Sunday, October 13th, and Norman Brown on Sunday, October 20th. More information at BethesdaTheater.com.
I'm Candy Shannon, and you are tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
And welcome to WPFW Washington at 89.3 FM. This is the hour of We the People, brought to you by your Pacifica Foundation radio station. Importantly, supported for more than 47 years by listeners like you, bringing you jazz and justice, building a better world, one broadcast at a time. I'm your host, David Whetstone, and again, this hour is We the People. We're going to do post-debate observations. Vice President Kamala Harris debated former President Donald J. Trump last night, and we're going to get some post-debate observations. Our guests are Dr. Ayanna Bess, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Howard University. Dr. Bess previously held a research position at the USC Center for Feminist Research, working on projects addressing homelessness for women of color in California, and she has researched redistricting effects upon Black communities. Her forthcoming book focuses on the effects of state-sanctioned violence on Black women's political participation and civic engagement. Dr. Marcus Board Jr., also of Howard University, is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science there. His research areas are American politics, Black politics, and political theory. At the center of his research and activities is liberation. His most recent book is Invisible Weapons, Infiltrating Resistance and Defeating Movements. Dr. Bess, Dr. Board, thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having me.
You're most welcome. So before we get into talking about the debate and how it fits into our election year, I'd like to give you both an opportunity to talk about how your work is relevant to what our listeners would have in broad political concerns. What is it about your work that focuses you on your attention on the debate and beyond. Dr. Best, why don't you start out, please?
Yes, well, my work focuses on the political behavior of Black people. More specifically, I focus on, with the book, the political behavior of Black women and how that is related to certain violent encounters that we have with the state, particularly our local police departments. And I think it was very evident that that was a topic or an issue that needed to be addressed. It was brought up slightly in ways by both candidates, but I think it's very important and very interesting to look at to understand how Black women will move and will be very influential in this upcoming presidential election.
Yes, I'm noting that Black women are the particular demographic that have the highest civic and, dare I say, voting participation, particularly when it comes to national elections and state elections.
Yes. And when there is
go ahead, please.
Yes, and when we see descriptive representation, having a woman of color as the presidential candidate, this Black women are galvanized by this. So hopefully, and I predict that we will see Black women come out in full force for Kamala Harris.
Yes, and we're also based here in Washington, where we broadcast from. People are mindful that this is the week of the Congressional Black Caucus Annual Legislative Conference as well. I want to do a marker, but without further delaying Dr. Board, I just want to say that given the career of the vice president, she's a proponent of an understanding of smart on crime policies. And we can further describe that later in our conversation if you think that showed up during the debate. And then in contrast, Donald Trump has made appeals, particularly to police unions, predominantly white and male, about police having more support, and I put quotes around support, and having more of a free hand to probably correlate to his notions of justice. So I just want to do those markers. Dr. Board, go ahead. Your theme of liberation is, as I know, is reflective in both your work and your activities in our community.
Very much, yeah. And I'm actually calling in from CBCF today, so very happy to be here. I think the biggest connection between my work and the debate to understand how this rising threat and existence of fascism in the United States is not necessarily benefited by neoliberal politics, for which I think Vice President Harris would be subscribed to. And so it's one of these challenges to be able to have conversations about political ideologies and the ways that our policies and practices and preferences are actually pushing us towards accepting more of the Donald Trump type of behavior. I think it's one of the things that we saw in the debate where, despite the fact that it, in many ways, too many ways, it was very unserious. At the same time, many of the points that Trump was making, critiquing the withdrawal from Afghanistan, critiquing the failures around student loan debt forgiveness, critiquing the challenges around a host of issues, I'll just say, that those were accurate points. And so it's one of those kind of catch-22 moments where this guy who was saying the most outlandish, racist, vile, I mean, the racism seemed pulled straight out of 1920, which was, I guess, interesting. And yet, the points that he actually made, the critiques, were actually spot on. That when everyday people, and this is what my work really gets into, when everyday people see that, then they see, you know, a rock and a hard place. And I think Trump is a worse than a hard place. But the fact that, you know, Harris is running a bit to the right of Biden, I think is a big problem for everyday people who actually need to see some substantive change. Do I think that it will change in the long run after she wins? Of course. But I do think that some of these challenges persist. And at some point, we need to be able to see them on the main stage, given that we didn't get an open primary.
So I just want to catch the main thrust of you offered a lot there for us. I've had you on before around your book earlier. It hasn't been that long ago. Your book being Invisible Weapons, Infiltrating Resistance and Defeating Movements. So when you mention neoliberalism, please tell the audience what your understanding of that ism is. And then I take it with the full stretch of your comments, you're really pointing us to a sense of you have ideologies, not just merely right or left, but claiming the center that are quite co-optive of social progress and social movements. But if you will, just explain it a little bit more, if you like.
Sure, I'd love to. So the big thing with neoliberalism, the neo being new, it's the new face of liberalism. So while you have a commitment to many progressive social issues, whether it is a woman's right to choose, women's fertility and health, and abortion, as we saw with Paris, you also see some regressive state policies that push further to the right on issues like policing, on militarism. So it's one of those challenges with neoliberalism that you see contradictory positions. So on one hand, you have a commitment, a leftist, justice-based commitment to environmentalism and trying climate disaster, while at the same time reinforcing militarism, which is one of the biggest reasons why climate disaster is such a problem. It adds disproportionately to that problem. And so you see these contradictions. The argument is that these neoliberals are trying to be more centrist, and they are very effectively, but at the same time, that centrism really opens the door for fascism. So it's one of the biggest difficulties that folks are having, and particularly in the Democratic Party, is saying that we need to be more centrist to get these voters, right? This is the calculation that we need to win elections. The problem is, by doing that, you're opening the door for fascism. And so fortunately, I think, for the Democratic Party, if you know, for those who are committed to their success, fortunately for them, I believe that Trump is forcing the Republican Party to be a big tent party. There are Trumpers and there are never Trumpers. And they haven't necessarily learned how to navigate that type of environment. But when they do push back to the center, when they get more candidates like Mitt Romney, like John McCain, when they get back to that, the Democrats are they're going to have a bit of trouble on their hands.
Right. So we've given an initial framework through the perspectives of what you both are occupied with. Let's get back to the basics, so to speak. Dr. Bess, how do we get beyond viewing a debate as a win or lose game? The media seems to make its fair contribution to turning politics into kind of a horse race, that there must be a winner, there must be a loser. How do we get beyond that? What should be purposeful when we pay attention to such things as the debate last night?
Yeah, so I think as the viewers, we need to be focusing on what kind of candidate we have in front of us. What is their stance on certain issues? How are they going to address them with policy? What are their values and what do they hold to be most pertinent to the American voters so that they will push for policy ramifications or different legislation if they become president. And I think a lot of times we focus on the sort of showmanship of the debates, and that is a big appeal for, you know, the viewer. It's really important to focus on what they are actually saying, what we actually are hearing as solutions to the problems that they so eloquently just bring up, but don't actually give us an end game, don't actually give us what are your goals when it comes to providing and fixing those issues that you brought up.
Allow me to delve into what I think I observed then. Part of the strategy for Vice President Harris was to distinctly roll out policy points. I won't say mere talking points, but she layered within her answers policy. And part of that, my group of stakeholders the media were constantly echoing that she hasn't presented policy. I'll take advantage here and ask you, Dr. Best, is that particularly engendered? I believe so, but what is your work and observation show?
Yes, it's very gendered. When we think about the stark contrast of the two candidates, we see that as soon as Kamala Harris decided to become the Democratic candidate, there was immediately, what are her policies? What does she stand for? What is she going to do? How is she different from Biden? However, when we just saw in the debate, Trump had no policies. He had concepts of policies and concepts of things that he was going to do. But that
and you're alluding to, particularly when he was questioned about health care. In fact, I even think, if I'm not mistaken, and I'm not conflating it, the moderators remarked about he and his party trying to modify the ACA, the Obamacare, at least 60 times. And yet, I believe one moderator said, you've had all these years plus your own tenure. What concepts do you want to present? And again, I'm just trying to facilitate our conversation. You were right in observing that he promised to roll out the concepts soon.
Yes. So he has had, as noted by the commentators and commenters and moderators.
The moderators,
that he has had the moderators, yes. He has had years to come up with a different solution or a different concept. And he still could not give us a solid answer on what a potential plan or option that he discussed would be, that he may choose. So it has been some time, yet Kamala has offered some solutions, and those are, you know, tending to not be as good or good enough for critics.
Allow me to reintroduce you both. We're talking to Dr. Ayanna Best. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Howard University. And also with the same department, the associate professor, Dr. Marcus Board. We're doing post-debate observations right here on We the People on WPFW FM at 89.3 and at WPFWFM.org. Thanking you both for being with us. If you allow me a moment, I was going to wait to the halfway point. But since we're a Jazz and Justice radio station, I just want to take a moment to remember Frankie Beverly, who died at age 77, the singer-songwriter for the group Maze. He, the silky, silky soul singer, is joining yet another soul singer as an ancestor. And you'll be hearing more right here on WPFW about Frankie Beverly, and we're going to miss him so. R&B music will not be the same in his absence, yet he leaves us a rich legacy. Dr. Board, again, thank you for being with us. Dr. Best, the same. Dr. Board, people, whether it's in the barbershop or in the street or at a protest, they're looking for the workings of politics to deliver something. In your case, you're really concerned about the liberation of people. How can we go further in understanding the rhetoric, the actions, the behavior? Isn't the debate just a moment? It's not necessarily part of the movement that people want.
I think I understand your question. So I think one of the things to understand about debates is that it's political theater, right? If you really want to understand the candidate's campaign, their policies, their positions, their platform, things that they stand for, you go to their website, you look it up. You can parse their words. You can see how they handle pressure. And so in many ways, I think the Harris campaign did a great job recognizing that this was more of a show than it was, you know, an oral exam, so to speak. So she was there to show.
Indeed. In fact, could I say she turned to the camera to look at the public and then had moments of deliberately turning and looking at her opponent.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the reality is she is in a position that very few people are equipped to even handle. She can't be too smart on TV because people don't necessarily want to see that, but she has to be smart enough to clearly articulate a set of positions. She can't be too serious because she's standing next to Trump, but she has to be able to make sure she gets her points across, even though she got less talking time. She has to be able to get her points across while also acknowledging the fact that this person that she's standing across from is not meeting any basic standard of governance. And so it was a really tough position. And so in that sense, I think she did a fantastic job managing and navigating that space and coming out looking as though she was the adult in the room who people want to, at the very least, be in a position rather than, you know, the guy who has shown consistently, including his experience as a president, that he has no serious focus or capacity for the position.
Well, your comments make me lead to just spend a little bit more time talking about the workings of stuff before we go to the break. Mm-hmm. Would the media... Or, you know, I'm catching myself. Let me rephrase the question I'm about to ask. Does the media frame and condition debates? And is that framing, does it really make a difference? Are they really serving a voting public? In other words, what should we be doing? Should we be doing anything differently? Let's start out with Dr. Bess.
I think the media does frame these debates to suit their target audience and serve the needs that they assume their target audience may have. And they often are not as impartial as they may want to be when coming to debates. For example, like when NBC decided to ask Marco Rubio his thoughts after the debate, but didn't give any other Democratic elected officials the opportunity to give their thoughts. So it's very, very strategic, very targeted to the audience and their viewers that they, their viewership.
And Marcus Board, would you like to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think the role that the media plays is contingent on the society we live in. So there's the world as it is, and there's the world mm-hmm. as we would particularly would like it to be. We would like the world where people are politically educated, they're civically engaged, that they have a level of knowledge and commitment to the political process such that we can treat them as a whole as experts, at least at the very least, of their own experiences and lives. We don't live in that environment. And so, yes, the media plays a huge role in hyping up these moments, and these moments do have to play a huge role in turnout because the way that our system is set up right now is very sensationalized. It's very looking for conflict. It's looking for, you know, explosive ideas. And because of that, yes, these moments of political theater do have a huge impact on whether or not people are going to even show up to vote. And, you know, in the United States, people tend not to.
If we can even go further, Dr. Board, how did the moderators do then, given what you just have said about an informed public and active citizenry?
I actually thought they did pretty well. I think they promised to mute the mics, which I think was more of a threat than an actual reality.
When the mics were open at certain points.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But generally, in the sense of fact-checking, I think they did a pretty good job. You know, journalists are trained, as you know, the media journalists in particular, as those were on stage, are trained to be a type of unbiased, which, as Dr. Beth and I know, you know, Patricia Hill Collins talks about standpoint theory, the capacity of a person to be completely neutral, to be completely objective, to be completely unbiased, is relatively non-existent. And so when they perform this type of even-handedness, it kind of gives credence to a both sides kind of argument.
A both sidesism. It makes a moral equivalency, so to speak.
That's exactly right. That it legitimizes foolishness, right? And so I think, while, you know, I'm not a journalist, and so, you know, each industry has their standards for reasons that they so choose. At the same time, I do think that when somebody is I don't want to repeat the things that Trump was saying, but when he says some of the outlandishly racist things that he says and misogynist things that he says, I think it responding as if it were just something someone said and we need to just check it is as if we are in a classroom taking a test. And the reality is they need a break. They need to sit down in the corner, give them a juice box, and think about what they said. But in this context, because of the way the U.S. political system is set up, they did the best they can, as Mariah Carey said, with what they had.
Well, you're being kind, and we're going to squeeze off a little bit more of this question and just say, quite frankly, when Mr. Trump talked about immigrants eating cats and dogs, David Muir was able to say, well, ABC News investigated that. We talked to a city official, and it wasn't true. And
yeah, I mean, it reminds me of what Toni Morrison said, that the purpose of racism is a distraction. They tell you that you're doing this thing, and so now we got to go investigate it. They tell you you're doing that thing, and now we got to go investigate it. And I think sometimes this objectivity thing will lead you down pathways that are idiotic, asinine, and foolish.
Wondering, Dr. Bess, if you have anything further to add. I'm particularly intrigued by the fact-checking that was going on by the moderators, but it seemed also that there was a strategic engagement on the part of Vice President Harris.
Yes, and I think while I really appreciated the fact-checking, especially when it came to conversations around women's health, reproductive rights, I do wish that there was some more probing of both candidates on actually answering the questions at hand. They attempted to do that in reiterating the question or repeating the question directly, they still were not able to get solid answers. And I think as a journalist, there needs to be ways where we can sort of recenter the conversation to get at the actual issues at hand and get those questions answered that we all want to know.
Well, we're coming up on our break, but may I quickly ask? I've got both candidates in mind, but I'm thinking that Vice President Harris did debating, but she also redirected quite frankly, focus when she was, you know, addressing her opponent. Some would break that down into offering bait, which Mr. Trump took, to be quite frank.
Yes, and he took it quite often.
So,
when she mentioned the Wharton School, she knew that he went there, and he was going to say something about it. When she mentioned his crowd size, you know, that really set him off. It seems like after that, it kind of went on a non-ending tangent about the same thing over and over again. So she did very well at baiting him with the appropriate things that she knew he was going to bite at, and he did.
Senator McCain, Charlottesville.
Yes.
And other things. Listeners, you're listening to We the People right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. Our guests are giving us post-debate observations. They are Dr. Ayanna Bess and Dr. Marcus Board, both of the political science departments at Howard University. We'll be back after this break, in which we'll give you some public service announcements. Please stick with us, and thank you for listening.
School is back. Do you need an after-school program for your young one? The Words Beats and Life Academy is enrolling for students from third grade up to young adults, with programming weekdays, 3:30 to 6 p.m., offering classes in hip-hop performing and visual arts, as well as business and arts leadership, with access to professional teaching artists, equipment, and resources. Located in Columbia Heights, Northwest Washington, D.C. at St. Stephen's Church. Classes are always free. Enrollment at wblinc.org/academy, based on availability. The fall session begins September 9th. We hope to see you or your young one there at the Words Beats and Life After School Academy.
All right.
Remember, wblinc.org/academy.
And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. More importantly, my guests, Dr. Ayanna Bess and Dr. Marcus Board, both political scientists who teach at Howard University. And we're, again, doing post-debate observations. Again, thanks to you both for being with us. I would ask this because I suspect at least people do this minimally when they watch a debate, particularly if it's about a senatorial election or a presidential election. What topics came up? What topics weren't mentioned? Dr. Board, why don't you start us off?
Sure. So I think Dr. Bess has been saying this a few times, but they talked about a handful of things, but never went fully in depth far enough. And so, as I mentioned earlier, we talked about climate crisis. We talked about Israel and Palestine. We didn't talk about genocide, but we didn't make the connections that militarism and climate disaster go hand in hand. They go together real bad. So we didn't talk about that. We didn't get into enough policy, in my opinion, that would really, and particularly like the things that Harris is differentiating herself from Biden on. So things like elder care and child care, I think we didn't get enough into raising the minimum wage or public colleges. Biden ran on decriminalizing or changing the categorization of certain illegal drugs. We didn't really get into that. We didn't get into the issues of mass incarceration. So they Trump tried to get her, so to speak, on supporting defunding the police, which of course she does not. But we missed the opportunity then again to get into a deeper conversation about what impact the Movement for Black Lives has had on U.S. politics and how we have learned from or how we have learned from that movement, or if we've just pretended like it didn't exist and we can move forward. So there are a lot of things that we could have talked about, Trump packing the courts and the way that that has affected U.S. politics so significantly, the loss of affirmative action. There's a million things we could have talked about more in depth. But again, like I said, I recognize that this is political theater and folks were not there to do that. The masses of folks were there to feel good about one or the other candidate so that they could decide who to vote for.
Well, I want to go a little further with that, too, and do a media focus. I'm going to use some shorthand here that I think you both would understand. It seems like there was a gotcha reflex on the fracking question. And for those who might be new to that concern when it is dealing with our present vice president, a media person, an interviewer will say, you had this position on fracking and now you've changed. My interest in raising this right now is it seemed that even with the moderation that went on last night, it leaves little room for a politician to honestly say, I've become more informed on this issue. I've evolved, and I will always rise to what is compelling, given what we can commonly agree upon facts, and in this case, science. There's little room for that. Am I mistaken? Either one of you can extend this further, please.
No, you're not mistaken. I think
that's the theater that you're talking about, Dr. Board, I think.
That's right. The reality is that in the theater, the character that grows and evolves might be the protagonist, But in political theater, they're the loser. You don't show weakness. You don't apologize. They were both asked. Trump was asked if he wanted to rethink or if he regretted anything about his role in January 6th. Of course, he doesn't acknowledge that he played a role and that he's not responsible for it. In the same way that Harris was asked about the withdrawal from Afghanistan, to which she said something else as well. She deflected as well. The reality is that in this political environment, with what we have, despite what we might want, you cannot show growth. You cannot show accountability. You can change, but you must say, I'm here because of these reasons. You can't necessarily spend time explaining how you got there. Why that's the case? Well, that's probably a longer conversation about the U.S. Relationships to expertise, to elitism, and to the challenges of everyday people. But in the meantime, yeah, it's hard to fault candidates for what is the reality of the environment that we're in. Now, does that mean we need different candidates? I would say so. But in the meantime, these are the ones we have, and we got to work, you know, again, you know, I'm going back to Mariah Carey. Well, you got to do the best you can with what you got.
So the constraints that we're describing, Dr. Bess, are particularly vexing for people of color and women in their political participation. It seems to me like the debate was a striking contrast with other interviews and other news treatments of Vice President Harris. She at least, is it fair to say, took up her own space and set her own agenda? Or am I going too far with this?
Yes, I think really the biggest contrast between the two candidates was Harris did a better job at presenting tangible action plans when it came to economic growth and policy, whereas we did not see that at all with Donald Trump. So you can tell that she practiced, that she came to this debate much more prepared than her opponent, and it paid off when what we saw as actions.
So I'm mindful of the day after, the commentary within parties, in the news media, the person on the street interviews and such. Let's begin to grapple with how this might fit into a framework of, if I can say quite frankly, the political activism or participation that either of you want to see. Dr. Bess, why don't we start with you? Because a good part of your career is really distinctly focused on Black women's civic engagement. We've had Vice President Harris's good fortune to be the candidate of her party comes out of a long, long reach and a long amount of hard work on the part of other women of color as well.
Yes, I definitely agree. And we, you know, as political scientists, as Black scholars, Black feminist scholars, we know that she is in the position she's in based on the hard work of women like Shirley Chisholm, based on the Barbara Jordans and the Maxine Waters as well, who have...
And Shirley Chisholm and Ida B. Wells and...
And the Ida B. Wells and Mary Church Terwells and a number of Black women who, Fannie Lou Hamer, who made their voices heard in spaces where they were clearly unwelcomed. And it now all of this hard work it seems to be finally paying off. So I have high hopes that, and with all of the hard work that Black women are doing to make sure that Harris gets into office cannot go without saying or cannot go unnoticed. All of the DNOT organizations and other community organizations are rallying around Harris as a candidate, and they're putting in the work, they're putting their dollar behind their word, and I definitely see the political participation of Black women as going far beyond just the ballot box. It's going into the streets. It's going into the bank. And this is what changes elections. This is what makes or breaks campaigns.
Dr. Board, where does accountability fit in to all this? I have talked to you before, and I think we both conclude no liberation without accountability, particularly in regards to people who hold office.
That's right. That's right. I don't think accountability is on the menu, and that is one of the reasons why I do the work that I do, Adiva Woodley's work, Regina Gauss's work, a lot of folks who do work around movements and justice work will point out that the only time accountability is truly happening on that stage is when organizers, community builders, activists, and justice-oriented folks are showing up and showing out. Now, Harris has done a decent job of responding to folks who are asking her to do better. Of course, when I say responding, I don't mean necessarily accepting their position. So we know that she met with the uncommitted folks in Michigan. They have since decided to, you know, rescind their support for a candidacy and saying that they could not in good conscience support it. But she did at least meet with them, which is the lowest bar, but it is a higher bar than many presidents in U.S. history. Obama did something very similar. It's not a coincidence that the Movement for Black Lives started during his presidency, and I imagine that social movements during the Harris presidency will also be pretty loud and pretty active. So, you know, you need accountability. You need a space where people can say, hey, I've grown and I've learned on these issues. But as of right now, as we have seen for some time now, when you have descriptively representative candidates, that is candidates who are indicating some type of identity group, whether it's women, whether it's Black folks, whether it's queer folks, et cetera, if they are not necessarily committed to some liberatory agenda, then they'll actually push further to the right. And that's one of the challenges that we have, that in these historic moments where we are proud, we are grateful, we are excited for the movement into the future. As Harris said, we're not going back. We actually want to go forward. We don't just want to stay still. And that's one of the big challenges for folks. And that's what happens when you don't have accountability in politics.
Dr. Best, we're conducting this interview by phone, but I can sense that you might want to add something further. Am I right?
Yes. I just want to say that for as a political scientist and as a Black woman, this is a critical election. And I think we say this every year, every election. But to think about the political efficacy and political trust at this time for Black voters seems to be very low. And particularly for Black male voters. So thinking about this election as an election that could potentially shift democracy in a number of ways and shift the meaning of citizenship for marginalized communities is imperative that we continue to take action in more ways than one. And voting is not the only way we can take action. But thinking about how we can rebuild and continue to reinforce our community organizing, community collectiveness when we're going into this next presidential election.
And if we had our good friend Dr. Clarence Lusain, he would say what you just described, Dr. Bass, is important across the whole world in that it's the marginalized people. I'm thinking particularly of young people and students who seem to really create this new sense of governance, this new sense of being, this new sense of existing. I'm saying all this because I'm a little bit befuddled, and perhaps either of you can help out in this. We of the media make everything kind of a phenomenon, a flash of this moment and that. And one of the things that happened as a result post-debate was, dare I say it, Taylor Swift made her statements. And, of course, the media dutifully paid attention. So what can we say about different stakeholders coming maybe to the same conclusions, but not working necessarily together in the same places.
Yeah. Dr. Beth and I were talking a little bit about Tay-Tay earlier. You know, it's back to media and political literacy, which is to say that having, you know, Taylor Swift or LeBron James or Oprah or whomever, having these celebrities endorse a candidate is not the same thing as having them submit themselves to accountability, right? To commit themselves to doing the work that they need in community to change the world. Because the reality is the problems that we face are not individualized problems. They're collective problems, and we need collective solutions. And so it just further adds to the problems that we have in this political landscape of folks standing on an island and thinking that on that island, I can have everything I want. I don't have to do anything to get it. And everybody else around me, I'd rather they not have it if it's between them and me. We need more solidarity. We need better work in this area. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, shout out to Taylor Swift, I guess. Like, it's good. It was a nice statement. It matters. Her access to a particular demographic and electorate is important. But, you know, I think it's also really important that she stops using the private jet, right? I think it's also important that LeBron James speaks out on different racial justice issues. I think it's also important that Oprah pays her workers a fair and livable wage, right? Like, I think we could go on forever, right? Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, it's a bunch of super rich people doing things, and for whatever reason, our broke behinds think that could be me, and we wrong, but hey, it's the world we have.
I think it's extremely important, and it was strategic of her PR team to do it in the way they did it. But it's unfortunate in some senses that she does have a large influence when it comes to young people and whoever her, I guess, supporters or listeners, her fans are. And the lack of political knowledge, unfortunately, can make us sort of disillusioned by what that endorsement could actually mean. So like Marcus was saying, or Dr. Bird was saying, if that endorsement came with Taylor Swift pledging to really commit to making some changes that would affect real people who are the people on the ground, the middle class that Harris so eloquently discusses, then we would see this actually being influential and not just a soundbite or not just a Instagram post.
Yeah, people were busy parsing out what fraction of her, 283 million followers are reflected in this country in this election year. So I'll just leave that there. You two have already done the work in us talking about her example. I know we have just a few minutes remaining. And I have asked this of you both when you've been previously on. You teach students. You know that they go out into communities. Everybody's busy, as the sophisticates say, with their quotidian, their everyday routine. Can we leave with a sense of a picture of some things you've already said? The debate and voting is only one part of the electoral process. It is not the definitive definition of organizing community, of building healthy communities. So basically, the simple translation of all that is, what would you like to see that truly reflects us moving forward? Either you can choose to start.
Okay, I guess that's me. Well, you know, I was talking with a few of my students during the debate last night, and they're scared, they're disappointed, They are struggling with the weight of knowing that we saw universities around the country violently attack them as they were, you know, building encampments, that they were sticking police on them like dogs, throwing them out of these spaces. And we never, you know, really heard about what we would do about that. We're seeing universities say, oh, well, we're not going to make statements anymore. And so they're worried that these moments are so big that all of the work that we do on a day-to-day basis is being overshadowed. And to that, I point them, you know, like James Baldwin says, I thought all my struggles were just mine, and then I read, right? And so I point them to the parable of the sower, to Octavia Butler, who almost impossibly imagined exactly the moment that we're in right now. And the whole point of that story was to say how this one young woman, this young Black woman, Lauren Olamina, planted a seed that thousands of years in the future would become the belief system that changed all of our lives. Because it is really the small things. It is the everyday things. It is the connected things. It's the communities we build. And, you know, you can't always guarantee that you're going to encourage someone when you try, but you still have to try. You still have to be hopeful. You still have to be disciplined. You still have to be engaged. And when you do that work, you give us a chance to live the life that we want everyone else to have. We can have it for ourselves in the meantime and do the work that we need to do to spread that message. So it's you know, elections are you know, an annual thing in the United States. They're their own hurdle. We organize around them, but we organize even more consistently around improving the lives of the people who we care about, who we know, and who we live with and share the world with every day.
And Dr. Bess, I believe that you're in of the same trajectory. What more do you want to say?
Yes. we know by research that these debates don't necessarily, you know, sway citizens either way. If they're in support of a candidate, they most likely will stay in support of a candidate. However, for young people, as I mentioned earlier, who particularly have a low level of political efficacy and political trust, and thinking that they don't really have the hope that, you know, previous generations may have to actually make sustainable change, or that things will ever get better for the communities that they have to go home to. Sometimes students and professors and academics, we live in a bubble, and we don't think about all of the real life things that are happening every day that people have to suffer through and go through, and how that makes them less and less likely to want to participate in this political, what, as Dr. Boyer called it, political like stage for this, you know, this show, this political show.
Political theater.
And we have to continue to reinforce to our students that, you know, you, your voice matters, you advocating for yourself matters, and it's the only way that we're going to continue to see any kind of progress, because the folks who run our country sometimes do not think about the quotidian or the everyday,
They summon rhetoric and behaviors that would lead us to think otherwise.
Right. they put on a good show. They make us believe that, you know, change is coming and things are moving and progressing. But the more they do, the more they seem to stay the same. So
it really comes down to us, doesn't it, Dr. Bess?
Unfortunately.
All right. And with that, I thank Dr. Ayanna Bess and Dr. Marcus Board, both of the political science departments at Howard University. They exemplify actual field work being related to theory, being related to learning, and they've been gladly sharing with us post-debate observations. You've been listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. My thanks to Mike Nasella for engineering the News and Public Affairs Departments at WPFW. Coming up 5 minutes before the hour, the news, but immediately next is not the Wednesday edition of Don't Forget the Blues with Clarence the Bluesman Turner. And at 1 o'clock, Africa Now with host Moesa Mutale. Thank you for listening. Take good care.
Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested.
World leaders are laughing at Donald Trump. I have talked with military leaders, some of whom worked with you, and they say you're a disgrace.
Vice President Kamala Harris excoriated Donald Trump in their first presidential debate last night over his refusal to accept his 2020 election loss and attempt to overturn it. Trump cited his ally, Hungary's far-right leader Viktor Orban, who faces fines by the European Union for rollbacks on EU freedoms. During the two-hour debate, Trump took typical aim at immigrants, repeating xenophobic falsehoods and conspiracy theories, like one circulating about Springfield, Ohio.
In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there.
He also blamed immigrants for crime, and Harris responded.
Millions of people let in, and all over the world, crime is down all over the world except here. Crime here is up and through the roof.
Harris. Well, I think this is so rich. Coming from someone who has been prosecuted for national security crimes, economic crimes, election interference, has been found liable for sexual assault, and his next big court appearance is in November at his own criminal sentencing.
Harris boasted of her Republican support. Some 200 Republican leaders, including former Vice President Dick Cheney, who helped lead the U.S. to wage a war in Iraq based on lies. When asked about her shifting position on issues like fracking, Harris doubled down her support of it and said her values haven't changed. Her campaigns invited Trump to a second debate next month. He's considering it. House Speaker Mike Johnson's doubling down his pledge to tie government funding to the SAVE Act, a bill to require proof of citizenship when registering to vote. It's backed by Donald Trump.
If you have a few thousand illegals participating in an election in the wrong place, you can change the makeup of Congress and you can affect the presidential election. The American people understand this. It doesn't matter what party people are in. They demand, they want us, and they deserve us to take this action and make sure that illegals cannot taint the election. Only U.S. citizens should vote in U.S. elections.
A survey earlier this year from Maryland University says 1 in 10 voters say they cannot easily access proof of citizenship. It's dead on arrival in the Democratic-controlled Senate. Here's Senate leader Chuck Schumer.
Only bipartisanship will help us meet that deadline. But instead of pursuing bipartisanship, Speaker Johnson is yet again, wasting time caving to the hard right despite his razor-thin majority. Hasn't he learned? Instead, Republicans should work with Democrats on a bipartisan package, one that has input from both sides, one that avoids harmful cuts.
Those harmful cuts, Democrats say, include cuts to veterans care. Lawmakers have until the end of the month to strike a deal before a partial government shutdown. President Joe Biden today says he's outraged and deeply saddened by the killing of an American activist in the West Bank by an Israeli sniper, calling it totally unacceptable and demanding